keeping you current on all things criminal. This is Crime Feed. Crime Feed. With Darren Kevinoki and Lonnie Coombs.
Welcome to Investigation Discovery's Crime Feed podcast. I'm Darren Kevinoki.
And I'm Lonnie Coombs.
Of course you are. And partner in crime. And we're delighted to be covering the ripped from the headlines cases that, of course, everyone is talking about.
And remember, this is a weekly podcast, so make sure you come back every week to listen to me and my partner in crime.
Yeah, that's it. And by the way, don't be reluctant to tell your friends about it too. Like, share on that Twitter machine and everywhere else and tell some folks.
Yes. Meanwhile, let's jump right into it.
Shall we?
Yes. So our first case this week is Bill Cosby. Now, obviously, Bill Cosby's going on for a while, but I don't know if you saw the magazine cover. It's been getting a lot of coverage here. On the front of the New York magazine, there is a front cover that shows 35 of the allegedly 46 women who were sexually assaulted by Bill Cosby over the years. It's striking. It's unusual that sexual assault victims are portrayed like this, but they all obviously consented to it.
Well, it's amazing because typically in a sexual assault case, the victims are referred to as Jane Doe,
right.
And there are significant measures that prosecutors and journalists take to shield their identity.
Right. Even the media, who is not used to, you know, usually being so circumspect, usually is very careful about, you know, shielding the identity of alleged victims of sexual violence and abuse. However, in this case, they're right there on the front cover. And then obviously in the magazine, they tell each one of the stories of these victims. Now, what's interesting is people are saying, okay, what does this mean? Besides the fact that now we're getting more details, we can see them all. And there's actually something else that occurred just recently that is going to have possibly a really big effect on Bill Cosby and whatever type of lawsuit might actually come out of
Wait,
this.
Wait, is this big effect that you're talking about, Lonnie, is this going to make things better for him?
No. Absolutely not.
Sorry, that was sarcasm.
Right. So when you hear about lawsuits, all you hear about is, oh, the statute of limitations, it's too late, no one can bring any lawsuits. However, the Supreme Court made a ruling in California just recently on one case that is being brought by Gloria Allred, a very famous defense attorney who's representing a lot of these victims.
Well, and her thing is really championing the rights of victims, right? That's how she's become
she
so widely known.
A bulldog. She does not let go of things, and she did not take the fact that most of these cases were barred by the statute of limitations to stop her. So she has one client named Judith Hulth. Huth, H-U-T-H, who is one of the alleged victims, and she said that she was violated back in 1974 when she was a 15-year-old, but she did not bring charges until 2014 when she came to the police, obviously without outside the statute of limitations. However, there is a little window in the civil lawsuits for sexual assault that actually opens up the statute of limitations. And this is a recent change in the law in the 1990s. And essentially what it says is if you repressed your memory of childhood sexual abuse, we're not going to hold you liable if you didn't report it, obviously because you didn't remember it. However, from the time that you remember it, perhaps as an adult, no matter what age you are, from the time that you remember it, for 3 years, you have a window to go report it to the police.
To go and bring your case. So, and here's what's interesting, and maybe just a quick little bit of context, that cases can either be in civil court where people are fighting about money,
right,
or there can be criminal cases where somebody's being prosecuted for a crime. And in either of those scenarios, whether it's civil or criminal, the law says, look, there is a period of time in which this case has to be brought or else it's unfair.
I mean,
fundamentally,
unfair
it's about
fairness. Accused.
That's unfair to the accused or the defendant to bring this case. And that's what we're talking about when we're talking about a statute of limitations. In the criminal cases, it's been, I think, fairly well settled, although there's still some legal jousting going on about whether any of these incidents can subject Cosby to any kind of criminal liability.
Because of the statute of limitations, and it does vary from state to state, but essentially, usually when you're about 26 years old or later than that, it's pretty
too
much
late.
Too late.
It's
too late. Yeah. So, and that's what would have happened in this case because she was here in California. But because there's this civil statute of limitations,
and that's
we're
a
not
big news here.
Yes. And we're not talking about jail. So people are saying, will Bill Cosby ever go to jail? Most likely not, unless Gloria Allred can find someone who was within the criminal statute of limitations. However, this civil lawsuit, because the Supreme Court here in California now said, you can go ahead with this. She's claiming a repressed memory. She's claiming that it falls within the statute of limitations. And so far, we believe you have a case. You can proceed with this lawsuit.
So she's been now given the green light to go forward and sue Cosby civilly, which means that he's going to be able, or he'll be forced to answer questions in a deposition and make admissions. And obviously you cannot duck the legal process,
right,
in a civil lawsuit. And what I also find fascinating about this, and I think it's important for ID listeners to understand, is that just saying you've got a repressed memory of something isn't enough.
Right.
There's some additional showings that
Absolutely.
Have to happen.
Obviously, this kind of, you know, claim is very open for fraud here. And so what the law required is that you have to have what's called a certificate of merit, which is where a licensed therapist actually certifies that you did have this repressed memory and that apparently
and that the memory
you just
got surfaced at some
right.
point.
Yeah. Now, one defense that can be raised, and actually Bill Cosby's attorneys are raising it in this case specifically, is to say, hey, you didn't just remember it recently. You actually brought this incident up 10 years ago. In fact, you tried to extort Bill Cosby 10 years ago, saying you would go to the media and talk about this 1974 incident at the Playboy Mansion.
But that's potentially a really good defense, because
defense.
Under what this court ruling is that assuming that you can get over those hurdles about having a certificate of merit that you had this repressed memory, they're saying, look, you've got 3 years from
right.
the time that repressed memory has surfaced to bring your case. And if you were trying to get money from him 10 years ago, guess what? You're out of luck.
Right. So this is a great win for the prosecution, for Gloria Allred, being able to say, okay, we can proceed with this lawsuit, but there's still a lot to be argued on both sides.
Yeah, well, what's interesting is the silence that's coming out of Cosby's camp right now is deafening. Yes, exactly. And, you know, it's so interesting because Cosby hasn't come out with anything in response to this, or at least anything that I've seen.
Well, he personally, apparently they have a new attorney on board now on the Cosby team who did come out and make the rounds and speak on his behalf somewhat just recently. But as far as Bill Cosby himself,
nothing
other than what we've been hearing from the deposition. Remember, this 1,000-page deposition from this prior 2006 case has come out, and you've heard quite a bit of stuff coming out from Bill Cosby that's a little bit surprising. He kind of comes across as cavalier, a playboy. He talks about his sexual encounters. Yeah, he talks about his sexual encounters with these young women. He talks about buying Quaaludes, you know, in anticipation of having sex with these women. So right there, you're kind of getting that image of Bill Cosby, the famous, you know, TV dad, is starting to be, you know, deteriorate.
Well, that was the rationale for releasing that information in the first place. And the judge specifically made findings about this and why the public's interest really ultimately prevailed, because of the jarring juxtaposition between who Cosby held himself out to be,
a moralist,
and who the deposition testimony revealed him to be. So does Cosby have a career, or is that career done?
What do you say, Lauren? I think no. I don't think, especially with these types of charges, with so many women, with the fact that it is such a blatant juxtaposition from what he was putting himself out to be, and the fact that all of these months have gone by and he refuses to take any responsibility.
You know, the only thing I would say that the answer is a definitive maybe, and I'll leave the door open just this tiniest little bit. It would really take something, but I think about how much we love to see people fall, but we love a comeback story. And it would take an act of the heavens parting to turn Bill Cosby into a comeback story. But could it happen? I don't know. I look at my poster child of Robert Downey Jr., right? People didn't think he was going to bounce back.
No, but that was what he was hurting himself. He wasn't hurting other people and then lying about it. I think there's a big difference.
Yeah, you know, it was a different era, Lonnie. Mm. We'll see. We'll see.
All right. On to the next case. This is a case that came out of Milwaukee. The case itself is fairly simple. So there's a store owner who's in his store, and it's all caught on videotape. Thank heavens he had his surveillance camera going. So these very brazen burglars who had stolen a minivan rammed the stolen minivan into these concrete posts that are blocking the entrance of the store. And then they squeeze around, and they're coming into the store. And here's this store owner standing there, and they make eye contact, and he can see that these burglars are armed. So he goes and he gets his shotgun, and he starts shooting at these burglars, and he actually hits one of them several times. They take off to take the wounded burglar to the hospital, dump him essentially, and they're not talking. But the question here is, you know, can you defend your property? Can you defend your store with deadly force like that?
But wait, was he defending his property in a store or his life? Because if I'm sitting there and I see that there are these armed intruders coming and I'm defending myself, I don't think it's about what's on my store shelves. I'm thinking about defending myself. So I'm making it home at the end of the day.
Yeah. And here's two little quick other tidbits before we get into the, you know, more of the law here. But this same store, an employee there had been shot by a burglar just last fall. And then two of the burglars in this incident actually had hit another store owned by this same company, I guess, in 2012. So there's this history. They're used to being burglarized, apparently, and also being shot at. So that probably was in the mindset of this store owner as he fired his shotgun several times.
But if you're a business owner or not, if you're just a citizen and you're concerned about protecting yourself and your family, those you care about, I think it's a fair and important question to ask about what is it that I'm allowed to do to defend myself in any given situation?
And this is a very good question, and it depends on a lot of factors that you have to look at. One, are you in your home versus are you in your business? Are you defending your property versus are you physically being threatened with deadly violence, or is someone near to you being threatened, you know, defense of another, they're being threatened with deadly violence? It's all about the proportion of your response to what you're perceiving is coming towards you.
And the touchstone here, regardless of the circumstances, is always what's reasonable. And obviously the law is going to vary from state to state.
Right.
So it's important for listeners to understand that if this is a question that's burning brightly for them, that they want to talk to a lawyer that is in their state that can give them guidance about the facts and circumstances in their particular state.
Yeah. And this is also the area where we talk about stand your ground law, right? We've heard a lot about that coming up with the George Zimmerman case that popped up, and everybody was talking about it. 26 states have shoot first laws, essentially, which are stand your ground laws.
Where you can shoot first and ask questions later?
Essentially, you don't have a duty to retreat
before you use deadly force.
But in many states, you still have a duty to retreat. In some states, it depends on if you're in your home versus if you're out in public.
Right. So let's give a little context here, because when we're talking about duty to retreat and all of that, generally speaking, what we're saying is that before a person can use deadly force, number one, they've got to be in imminent fear that they're being attacked with death or serious bodily injury,
right?
That this isn't some trivial thing.
Right.
And you can never use deadly force just to defend property. You've got to use deadly force to defend yourself or another human being, right? If somebody's just making off with your stuff, that's not good enough. But in some states, you actually have an obligation to retreat before you are allowed to use deadly force. And in other states, you don't. And those are what we're talking about when we talk about the stand your ground states.
Right.
In stand your ground jurisdictions, you don't have the duty to run or get out of there at all. You're just allowed to use deadly force straight away.
And in some states, you even have to not just retreat. You have to tell the person to leave. Give them a chance to leave. So there's all these little quirks and specific details depending on the state you're in. So you really need to know the law within your own state as far as what actually constitutes legal self-defense.
But when the bad guy dies, and you know, this is something I think people really struggle with, because because it's always the bad guy who is dead or injured.
Well,
isn't it a nightmare for a prosecutor where all of a sudden it's the bad guy that's dead? And
yeah, well, actually, what it becomes is a nightmare for the person who shot him, the store owner, the homeowner, because
the shooter.
Right, because what happens is where it would have been the main focus on the intruder, the burglar, the robber, whoever it was, whatever crime they were committing, they're now dead.
Right. That's now, all shifting.
Right, now the focus goes to the shooter. Did they act in legitimate self-defense, or are they looking at a murder charge or some type of criminal charge for their actions? So that's why you have to be really careful.
Right. Well, and what adds insult to injury is sometimes these bad guys actually, if they will turn around and they'll sue.
Yes.
And there are reported cases where, you know, somebody who was burglarizing a home or robbing a store have actually sued the people that thwarted the crime. There was a case where there was a guy who was robbing a pizza restaurant. And the employees tackled him and attacked him and stripped the gun away. And the robber actually sued the pizza restaurant mm-hmm. and the particular employees for using excessive force.
Yeah.
And you know what? The judge has actually allowed that case to go forward.
Yeah.
It didn't die at summary judgment, which is where the court basically says, nope, there's no case here
yeah.
and dismisses the case. And the judge in federal court says, nope, this is a question for the jury to decide. So it really does turn on how much force is reasonable in yeah. a given scenario.
Yeah, believe me, sometimes there's some lawsuits that are crazy. A lot of times you see judgments given to criminals who are committed a crime, who are running away trying to escape while the police pursue them. If they get injured, or say the dog, you know, the police dog attacks them, they sue for their injuries, and then they actually get big monetary awards
right.
for their criminal activities. So it's kind
of the outrage of the week. Well, I think one of the big takeaways here, though, is that people really do need to consult with a lawyer in their own jurisdiction to find out about the laws that apply to them, because the laws do vary from state to state. And as much as you can get good insight and information from the internet, I would not want to stake my freedom on something that I read online. I think it's really worth a conversation with somebody that practices law in your jurisdiction and who knows what's up.
Yeah, once you decide that you're going to defend your home, your family, your property, your business with a gun, make sure you know the law first.
So speaking of knowing the law, there was a guy that I think knew the law, or really knew how to get around the law for a long, long time, Whitey Bulger. who had been engaged in a career of all kinds of lawlessness. You know, if you were on the East Coast especially,
mm-hmm.
I think it's kind of like Dunkin' Donuts was an East Coast thing for a long time. You know, Whitey Bulger, same deal, just notorious, one of the old school East Coast gangsters who, according to people that were in the know, really, really a bad, bad guy. And he's now serving, I think, a couple of life sentences.
Two life sentences for committing or ordering 11 murders in the 70s and 80s. That's what he was convicted of.
And he had been on the run for a long time.
Hiding out in Santa Monica.
Hiding out in plain
Remember?
Sight in Santa
yeah.
Monica.
Yeah.
And had been number one on the FBI's most wanted list for a long time. And although FBI agents joked that it was taking so long to get him that they thought it was on the least wanted list. But there he was, hiding out in Santa Monica, ultimately got captured, brought to trial. So he's back in the news again, because of what happened at his trial. So when his case went to trial, he Whitey, wanted to get up on the stand and testify about an assistant U.S. attorney, a prosecutor, who, according to Whitey, had given him immunity for a variety of crimes. And the judge says, nope, I'm not going to let you get up there on the stand and testify to those things. And so Whitey's response to that was, all right, well, then I guess I'm not going to get up and testify at all.
Mm-hmm.
And Whitey did not take the stand in his own defense at trial. By the way, legal nugget for our listeners, that people who are accused of a crime have an absolute right either to testify or to remain silent, or
right.
to not testify at the time of trial. So Whitey wanted to testify, but then in the face of this judge's ruling where he said, look, you can testify, I'm just not going to let you talk about this immunity deal, he did not take the stand. And now his lawyers are crying foul and saying, hey, look, you basically eviscerated my client's constitutional right to testify. We want a do-over. We want a new trial.
Yeah, well, that's what they argued to the Court of Appeals is, look, you said he could not testify. You kept him off the stand. But the prosecution said, no, look, All they did was what they do all the time. They determine what evidence can come in, and there's a lot of evidence that's not allowed into a trial. The judge said this one part of your testimony, you can't talk about this immunity. Now, whether that was because...
You just called this one little part, Lyon. This is like the whole...
But you don't know
testimony.
Why he kept it out. Maybe there was a legitimate reason. Maybe it wasn't true. Maybe he thought that Whitey was going to be getting up there lying about it. We don't know why the judge kept it out. But the judge did. He said, you can still take the stand. And the prosecutor said, the reason why he didn't take the stand wasn't because of the not being able to talk about this little immunity agreement. It's because of all the murders that we would have been able to cross-examine him on for days and days and days in front of the jury. That's why he didn't take the stand. Now the defense attorney is crying foul, like Darren, you are so passionately, because it's an appeal issue.
Yes.
Because they want to ask the court to reverse the conviction and put him back in the trial court.
You know what they say, Lonnie, a conviction is just the first step towards a successful appeal. But of course, we're still waiting to see how this is all going to shake out. There's been no ruling yet about this.
Right, but the interesting thing is, actually, if the Court of Appeals does rule in the defense's favor and says, we're going to wipe out the conviction, go back to court, in a way, the prosecution can say, great, let's go at it again, because there were actually more charges, more murders that this trial jury hung on. They'll be able to retry not just the ones he was convicted on, but they'll be able to go again on those other murder charges. He might end up with more time and more convictions than he did in the first
trial. Well, look, I mean, he's already sitting there with the double life sentence, so it's hard to imagine that the situation is going to be made worse. But here's my real beef with this, that at the end of the day, cross-examination is the greatest engine that the legal system has to get to the truth. And it's not up to the judge to say, oh, well, I don't know if I believe him. Like, put it out there. Let him get up and testify. Let the prosecutor have at him.
Yeah.
Cross-examine him. And then it's up to the jury to decide whether they believe it or not. Because the number one rule of trying cases, and I know you know this as a prosecutor as a judge, as much fun as it is to be in trial, you never want to do it twice.
Right.
And this sounds to me like a legal ruling that maybe is going to bring this case back to do it twice.
Well, because, you know, that right to testify is so sacrosanct. As we both know, if a defendant chooses not to testify and an attorney by accident just happens to mention it or infer to it in the closing argument, right
there,
grounds reversal. So, yeah, there's a chance here.
You know, one other bit of sad news to report today, the passing of Anne Rule.
Mm-hmm.
Anne Rule has died, and she is an amazing true crime author. Who has written more than 30 books. She was best known for the book about Ted Bundy, the serial killer, called The Stranger Beside Me.
Mm-hmm.
But what was so odd about the relationship between Anne Rule and Bundy is apparently they had known each other, or at least had some contact with each other.
They were actually co-workers at one period of time. And after she wrote this book, they actually stayed in contact with each other until he passed away.
Well, Anne Rule passed on at the age of 83, unlike Bundy, who was executed in Old Sparky, Florida's electric chair, back in 1989. Rule died at a hospital surrounded by loved ones, and really was somebody who was just a leader in the world of true crime writing.
She did. She changed the whole genre because she focused on the victims and their point of view and kind of gave empathy to the victims. And so it used to be kind of an old boys' school writing true crime and, you know, talking about the gory details and stuff. But she kind of changed the whole perspective and brought true crime genre to, you know, a wider audience. So anyways.
She will be missed.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. We've got some quick keeping our eyes on cases.
What are you keeping your eye on,
Lonnie?
Yeah.
I got a couple cases. The first one is Joyce Mitchell. As you know, she was the woman who
sounds familiar.
Yeah. The prison worker. Actually, she ran the tailor shop in the prison who helped those two guys who escaped. Okay. So she actually pled guilty. She pled guilty to one felony and to one misdemeanor. which is very interesting. The felony is promoting prison contraband, and the misdemeanor was a charge of criminal facilitation. She helped allegedly smuggle hacksaw blades and a screwdriver bit to the two inmates to help them facilitate their escape. Now, what's interesting about this plea is she was facing also possible sexual assault or rape charges, because she's admitted in her very lengthy statement to the police, which we're getting pieces of here and there, that she had sexual relations with one of the inmates. And there was also this allegation about them conspiring to murder her husband.
Yeah, her husband's got to be so pleased.
He was sitting on the front row of the courtroom as she pled guilty. So I guess they're still together.
That's a guy that needs to sleep with one eye open. I can't imagine that there's a restful night's sleep for him.
Well, under the terms of the plea deal, she will cooperate with the ongoing investigation with law enforcement. So I guess that's why she got such a sweetheart deal. And she comes back for sentencing next month, where she's looking at a maximum of 7 years.
Oh, I thought you were going to say she comes back to her job next month. I think when she's back in prison, it won't be as the headmistress of the tailor shop.
No, I think she's done with that career. On a really
well, she will be going back to prison, but just not in an old capacity.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. On a real sad note, we have an update on the Madison Middleton case. This is the 8-year-old little girl who had been seen riding a scooter around in this little arts center. Well, they arrested someone. They found her body in a recycling bin right there near the residential complex. And they actually arrested a 15-year-old boy who also lived there, and they believe knew the 8-year-old victim. And somehow he lured her into his apartment, killed her, and then concealed her body in this recycling bin downstairs. He had actually apparently been standing around the recycling bin, kind of hanging out while the police were searching the area for her body. They eventually were able to tie some things that were found in his apartment to the victim. So he's been arrested. He's in custody. He's been questioned. And now they're trying to decide whether to try him as an adult or not.
Well, in other news, Bobby Christina Brown, the daughter of Whitney Houston and Bobby Brown, has passed away, as you know. She passed on recently, July 26, 2015, surrounded by her family. The reason that this is something I think to keep our eyes on is because the criminal investigation is ongoing. Potentially, it's a murder case, could be a manslaughter case, could turn out to be nothing but an accidental or self-inflicted injuries that led to her death. Now, of course, since there is an autopsy, there may be new evidence that can help shed light on her tragic passing.
Yeah.
This is certainly something that we expect will continue to be in the news as evidence unfolds.
And they still have the civil case that was filed by the executor of her estate last month in June, you know, alleging abuse by Nick Gordon and also, you know, some other charges of taking money out of her estate.
Right. Yeah. This is it's a sad and odd case, and just a family that's been, you know, one saga after another, obviously. Yeah.
All right. We are moving on now to our dumbest criminal section. Okay.
Wait, do we get a sound of? We need some game show music.
Yeah. Okay. I am going to go ahead with my dumbest criminal. And actually, this is a dumbest criminal that is something that everyone should probably know about, because this might affect you. So this dumbest criminal is named James Huff. He was the former chairman of the Kenton County Airport Board in Northern Kentucky. He oversaw the Cincinnati and Northern Kentucky International Airport, a very big position. So he was trying to call his executive assistant on his cell phone number, but he got the wrong number. So he put his phone into his suit pocket and then accidentally, without knowing it, called the right number so that his assistant was on the phone, but he didn't know. And while the phone was open to his assistant, he starts having a conversation, what he thought was a private conversation, with the board's vice chair, Larry Savage, about possibly replacing the then CEO, Candace McGraw. So they're having this conversation. Well, the assistant's on the phone. She answers. She hears them talking. She can't tell what they're saying. She says, hello, hello. They don't hear her. So she finally realizes, hey, I think they're talking about unlawfully discriminating against this woman and taking her out. So she takes it upon herself to record the conversation and take notes for 91 minutes. Because this
on
guy.
On the butt dial.
Yeah, exactly. Because James not only talks to his vice chairman, but then he goes on and talks to his wife about this situation about trying to take this woman out. So she, the executive assistant, then takes her notes and the recording to the rest of the board members, and they take this guy down. So he appeals it and says, wait a minute, it was a butt dial. You know, I had privacy rights and this should not count. Well, this is where everyone should listen. Dun, dun, dun. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit in Kentucky said, butt dialing is akin to keeping your curtains wide open in your home. There's no rule that says people can't look inside. Wow. So if you butt dial somebody and they overhear it, you're going to be held liable for whatever they hear.
Well, I'm keeping my phone so far away. But that was felony stupid.
Felony stupid.
See, mine, I don't know. You always get to go first, and then I'm like, oh, mine sucks.
Oh, come
so
on.
So I've got mine is much more simple and straightforward. But I've got a guy who's a burglar. He broke into a home, and he's stealing stuff, including an iPhone. Mm-hmm. And as he's picking it up, he accidentally is shooting video of himself. And
it's all
of
about
course,
phones.
And of course, the owner, after he realizes that he's been burgled, is able to remotely access all of that material.
Wow!
And they actually have the guy's image. As a matter of fact, we'll have to put it up. Well, you know what? We're going to be Crime Stoppers on this one because this guy has not yet been apprehended.
Oh, there
but there's
you go.
A really good photo of him as he was filming himself doing the burglary. So you know, this was a home where people were in it at the time. Ooh. There was a woman and two 15-year-old girls asleep in the house.
Oh,
this
scary.
Could have been a really, really horrible situation. Thank goodness, not the case. It really is just another candidate for the dumbest criminal of the week.
Yeah.
But this one really spoke to me because I'm just such a fan of the selfie.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, from my last vacation, all the photos on my phone, which I'm not going to butt dial, it's all me. You know, here's my selfie in front of the Coliseum, and here's my selfie in front of some statue.
You got the selfie down.
As a matter of fact, my daughter says I should turn it into a coffee table book entitled "Me and Some Other Stuff in the Background."
There you go.
With some bad jokes along the way. Okay.
Well, I don't know if yours is the stupidest criminal, but it's the smartest victim to be able to access all that stuff remotely
I
from
know,
the phone. That's
right.
That's smart. Yeah.
I don't know. I guess maybe we're going to have to turn this one to the Twitter sphere.
There you go.
And we'll see whoever wants to vote for the winner this week for the dumbest criminal. So here's how let's do this. We'll tabulate and we'll release the results and make sure that you tweet us and you use at ID Crime Feed and use the hashtag dumbest criminals. You can also use the hashtag for us Crime Feed Podcast. But please, please, please stay engaged with us on Twitter. I'm a huge fan of the Twitter.
I am too.
And
we
love
respond.
When people reach out.
We respond
yes.
to people who reach out to us on Twitter. And don't forget, this is a weekly podcast. So every week, check in for new cases.
And if you have ideas for cases or stuff you want to hear us talk about or questions that you want to ask, anything legal, feel free, please, if you have any questions, just tweet us at ID Crime Feed and use that hashtag Crime Feed Podcast or Dumbest Criminals. On behalf of myself, Darren Cavanocchi.
And me, Lonnie Coombs.
Thank you so much for listening. We're really grateful. And if you want more shocking true crime stories, listen to us every week right here at the podcast. Watch Investigation Discovery. What else?
Or visit us on crimefeed.com.
Keeping you current on all things criminal. Crime Feed.
Crime Feed.
With Darren Cavanocchi and Lonnie Coombs.